Welcome to Off the Chart with Medical Economics, a podcast featuring lively and informative conversations with healthcare experts, opinion leaders, and practicing physicians about the challenges facing doctors in medical practices today. I'm Jeff Bendix, Senior Editor of Medical Economics.
My guest today is Dr. Scott Rivkes, Professor of Practice at the Brown University School of Public Health, a position he has held since 2022. From 2019 to 2021, he was Surgeon General and head of the Florida Department of Public Health. He's also been chair of the Pediatrics Department at the University of Florida School of Medicine. Dr. Rivkes is the author of a recent article on the website thehill.com about how scientific denialism is affecting state and local laws and helping to undermine public health. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. Rivkes.
Yeah, thank you so much. Honored to speak with you today.
Thanks. I always like to start my interviews by defining terms. So let's start out by defining the term denialism.
Yes. So really what denialism really represents is really a shift from normally conversations, disputes about particular notions to actually outright rejection of facts in a way that sometimes can actually be antagonistic and really completely ignoring the reality of the facts that are out there that are generally recognized.
What are some of the forms that it takes?
Well, so there can be a number of different forms of denialism. So, you know, some individuals will use selective reference of the literature to support a particular cause. Some individuals will end up using individuals who really are not experts in the field, but pretend to be experts in the field as well. Sometimes individuals will really twist response or something like such as efficacy of vaccines to actually say that vaccines are not effective at all. So again, it's often the use of selective use of the medical literature, selective use of individuals who are not medical experts at all to actually discount what is generally accepted in the medical community field.
It sounds like you're saying that they start out with the conclusion they want to arrive at and sort of work backwards from that.
Yeah, they can't, you know, and really to support a notion which is not generally accepted as true.
What is the mentality or worldview behind denialism? Talk a little bit about that.
You know, so first of all, you know, during this pandemic, you know, we really have seen a flurry of misinformation, which really reflects individuals talking about things with really not a clear intent to deceive, where individuals may say, my gosh, I really didn't mean to say that, I recognize it. But what we're actually seeing is really a more entrenched viewpoint, which actually is an offshoot of what some people also call disinformation. And this is really used to support a particular viewpoint.
You write in your article that more than 20 states have passed laws limiting the activities of state and local health departments. Can you give us some examples of some of these laws and how they're tied to denialism?
Yeah, so first of all, across the country, this is happening in many states. So, you know, one of the things that we're actually seeing is some people saying that that certain states had a very much laissez-faire approach to COVID-19. So because of this, you know, the public health measures really did not have a major impact. But really across the country, there were billions of dollars which went to support COVID-19. And helping to control the pandemic. So one of these things starts with the basic premise that some people fail to recognize the importance of public health and the healthcare sector had in terms of fighting COVID-19. So this has then led to legislative efforts and in some areas to actually really try to dismantle some core public health principles, such as the ability to quarantine individuals, such as the ability to make recommendations about following CDC guidelines. And now one of the things we're also seeing is the rise of individuals who are really trying to discount the role and effectiveness of vaccines, which have been really very quite effective during this pandemic. And this is actually spilling over into other forms of anti-vaccine legislation.
What are some of the states that have passed laws like these?
So this is something that is tracked by a number of different sites, and there are really many states where this has happened in terms of anti-vaccine legislation being introduced, anti-public health measures being introduced as well. And generally, these are more Republican-leaning states.
You were Florida's chief public health official during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. How did that experience affect your views about denialism?
You know, the first case of COVID-19 we had in Florida was March 1st, 2020. And I would say over that first year of 2020, the nation was generally on board in terms of almost a universal response to COVID-19. We had stay-at-home orders or safer home orders, talked about the importance of mitigation measures. And then when vaccines rolled out at the end of December 2020, there was widespread enthusiasm for this. But going into 22, we started really seeing progressive escalation of misinformation about the pandemic, which really challenged all of us in public health roles.
Florida, of course, was well known for adopting a more laissez-faire approach to dealing with COVID. Did that sit well with you? What was your response to that?
Well, I actually will say that we did not have a laissez-faire approach to COVID-19, yet we rather had a really aggressive plan. So in terms of Florida, a very medically vulnerable state, in terms of individuals 65 years in age and older, number two in the country. And if you look a year and a half into the pandemic, right before the Delta wave, in terms of where we ranked, in terms of cases per capita, we were about 29th. In terms of death per capita, we were 25th. And this was not the result of a laissez-faire approach. Rather, it was really the collective efforts of approaches from Department of Health, Division of Emergency Management, where we talked about the importance of mitigation measures, importance of testing, contact tracing, elderly and vulnerable population protection, supporting the hospitals, and also in terms of promoting vaccination.
But there were fewer mask mandates, correct? Fewer lockdowns, orders of businesses to close and so on?
Yeah, so again, you can break this down really into different phases. So like the rest of the country, around April of 2020, Florida did have what was called a safer at home order. And we promoted mitigation measures, promoted avoiding crowds and things like that. And then even when you went into 2021, we played a big role in terms of making sure that the public had masks, that the public had information about this. So even without there necessarily being mandates, you know, what we saw was that people doing the right thing in terms of trying to protect themselves and protect others.
Did you see denialism at work in any legislation introduced in Florida during that time?
Yeah, during that period of time, you know, in terms of Florida and in other states, this is where we started starting to see legislation being passed, trying to limit the role of different departments of health, and then also the role of different communities, the role of businesses to apply mitigation measures as they saw fit. And I think part of what's behind that is the fact that really trying to deny the effectiveness of measures that had been recommended by CDC or other members of the health community.
And what was the impact of that, do you think? Or did it have any impact?
You know, it's interesting. So you can break it down into a few different areas. So, for example, like in Florida, a ruling was put out that schools, you know, could not mandate students to wear masks. But even so, in that kind of a situation, we did a lot of things behind the scenes to keep students safe. And we had very few outbreaks in schools, same in the universities. In the business sector, businesses were prohibited, not just in Florida, but in other states, for what are called vaccine passports, meaning that you can't deny individuals entry to a service or to a business entity by having them having to show status of vaccination. So even with that, you know, there are other measures that businesses, schools, communities could do to keep individuals safe.
I want to pull back a little bit from our present situation and look at denialism in a historical context. It has existed in some form or other, more or less since the invention of the scientific method of inquiry. And it took a long time for people to accept ideas like the Earth goes around the sun. Even today, millions of Americans reject the idea of evolution. So I guess my question is, do you think denialism is more pervasive today than it has been in the past? And if so, how did it become so?
You know, one of the things that we are seeing, you know, and really started in 2021, as I mentioned early on, is really there has been this progressive rise of misinformation and disinformation. And with social media is now a bullhorn for so many different individuals. You know, we've gone from a time where news is communicated differently to a situation now where, you know, pretty much anybody is able to get a platform. You know, it used to be there were a handful of TV stations that would talk about the news, and they would actually talk about some of the facts, make sure that things are vetted. But we're in a really, really different aspect of society now, where there really is such broad communication, where individuals, you know, will be able to read so many different points of view, different viewpoints, often without correct facts being filtered.
Do you think
being filtered?
You actually kind of anticipated my next question, which is the media's role in fomenting and spreading denialism. It sounds like you think there has been a role, and is that because of giving unwarranted attention to deniers or people who are speaking without, you know, proper scientific background? How do you think that works?
People have looked at this, and if you look at what is out on social media now, or particularly started during 2021, you know, they actually can trace a lot of misinformation about vaccines to about 10 different purveyors of false information. And this ends up just becoming amplified to such a strong degree. And the other thing is that we really have challenged the role of the expert. You know, look at the attacks on different health officers, the attacks on CDC, the attacks on the FDA, agencies where we really have historically put our faith in terms of their expertise, in terms of healthcare, responding to other infectious outbreaks, to a situation now where we're saying, my gosh, you know, we are not trusting you anymore as we did in the past.
And do you think that's because of social media? What has led to that lack of faith in experts?
You know, I think, again, this gets into this notion of denialism, that we have a particular point of view, and we are not going to recognize viewpoints that we don't necessarily agree with. You know, somebody once created the term, you know, alternative facts, that we are going to, you know, where, you know, in terms of what mainstream medicine is saying, what mainstream science is saying, what mainstream public health is saying, these agencies which we have typically trusted for so long, we're saying, my gosh, all of a sudden, you know, we're going to go our own way and not listen to what you're saying.
Did you experience any of this as when you were Surgeon General in Florida?
Yeah, you know, first of all, you know, it was an honor to serve as Surgeon General. And I will say this is that, you know, Department of Health in Florida, we have 12,000 individuals. And every day we focused on what we needed to do to keep individuals safe and healthy, which included lots of messaging. So, you know, there certainly it was a lot of counter messaging to mitigation measures, counter messaging to vaccines, And what we would do is we would just try to continue to emphasize what we thought were, the important messages for the public to recognize.
Did you experience any personal attacks or ever feel personally threatened?
Yeah, in terms of threats to my own personal safety, no, but I received some, some spicy letters.
I bet. I know that people in your position in other states resign, including here in Ohio, resign because of fears for their safety and the personal attacks that they underwent. But it sounds like it didn't get to that level with you.
You know, it's interesting, during this pandemic, you know, about half of the state health officers turned over during this. And some of my colleagues really had personal threats. Some of my colleagues ended up having to have, you know, state police with them to help guard their person and keep them safe. As I said, you know, we were able to focus on what we did, and that's really what our activities were really directed at.
Your training and most of your professional career has been spent in pediatrics. You chaired the pediatrics department at the University of Florida. What led you to accept a position as Surgeon General, go into politics and pivot away from academia and then go back again?
Yeah. So first of all, you know, a lot of medicine really has to do with public health and keeping populations safe. Mm-hmm. I'm a pediatric endocrinologist. And one of the glowing success stories of public health is newborn screening, which I focused on early on. In other parts of my career, I worked with different state agencies related to newborn screening, which are part of typically parts of Department of Health. And then when I moved to University of Florida as department chair, became very interested in workforce issues, interested in how do we provide care to children with medically complex conditions. So I actually had worked with the Department of Health and had longstanding interests in public health. And again, so that really helped facilitate the transition into a larger state agency focused leading, the state of Florida's Department of Health.
What's it been like going back to academia?
In academia, I mean, I feel very fortunate to be able to come to one of the, premier schools of public health in the country. And one of the things that I'm doing is, we need to continue to make sure that we have very strong ties between academia and public health, and I'm focusing on that through educational activities, working at ways that we can continue to provide advanced training for our health officers as well. So, it's been invigorating to continue to work on in public health, but again, a little different way, but trying to help public health mesh with academia.
Until fairly recently, in this article, you hadn't written anything about denialism. What caused you to speak out now?
Since I left the University of Florida, left the Department of Health, I have published a number of pieces.
Okay.
Some of these pieces actually talked about setting the record straight about pediatric vaccinations. So, for example, in another state, a state health officer said that healthy children, should not get vaccinated. So I wrote a piece saying, well, if you look at children who get severe COVID, meaning children who are hospitalized or died from it, sadly, that most of those children did not have underlying medical conditions. Also, as other types of proper narratives have come up, I have written about that as well. So, this continues to be an extension of what we are seeing. Again, as we're getting into legislative season now, all across the country, we're tending to see, more anti-vaccine legislation being introduced, states where they're actually talking about trying to roll back vaccine requirements for children going to school. So again, we're seeing this crescendo of misinformation and also seeing this continuing to seep into the legislative system.
Have you gotten any response to the article you wrote for The Hill?
Yeah, I've had really some wonderful response from a number of medical organizations, a number of leading experts in public health and healthcare as well.
Positive, I assume.
Positive, yeah. A few spicy responses too, but overwhelmingly positive. And a number of individuals have actually retweeted this article and have shown me their tweets.
What's do you think that the scientific community or even lay people who are concerned about this can do to combat denialism?
One of the things that we really have to do is ask ourselves, who are we going to listen to when our children become ill? People who get into the field of medicine, our licensed health professionals who've had really many, many years of education. And we need to realize that there are people who have expertise in certain areas, and we've respected individuals before in medicine, and that we really need to continue to respect individuals in medicine, public health, healthcare sector in general. We also have to realize that we really are facing challenges like we never have seen before. So this really has to do really with grassroots efforts. Those of us in public health, those of us in the healthcare sector have to get the message out that you can trust us as authoritative sources.
My impression of people who don't use authoritative sources is that a lot of them exist in sort of an alternate information bubble, if you will. Is there a way for public health officials, scientists to penetrate that, do you think, and get accurate information to them?
It's interesting. During the early part of the pandemic, when vaccines came out, we initially would talk about vaccine hesitancy, and then it went to outright vaccine resistance. So there's some individuals that we absolutely are not going to be able to reach. But even so, we need to continue to get the messaging out. I'm just using vaccines as an example. Again, this gets into the megaphone of social media, where individuals can really broadcast information which is not at all accurate. So those of us in healthcare, public health, really have to really understand that we really have to continue to message the information that is accurate, and then also help people realize that they can go to us as a trusted source.
Well, that seems like a good note to end on. Thanks very much, Dr. Rifkis. This has been very interesting, and I think our audience will find it very helpful.
Yeah, thank you so much. Honored to speak with you. And again, we've had, as the pandemic is winding down, hopefully we'll be able to get to a situation where we really can make sure have the public realize who they can go through a trusted source of information. That will be their local public health official and their local healthcare provider.
Thanks for listening. You can subscribe to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. And when you do, please leave a review. You can find previous podcast episodes on our website, medicaleconomics.com, under the Media tab. We welcome your comments and suggestions for future podcast topics. You can email these to us at medec@mjhlifesciences.com. And while visiting our website, be sure to check out the latest news about the business of healthcare and explore the many other resources you'll find there. We hope you'll listen next month for a new episode of Off the Chart with Medical Economics.